Great. So last time we basically went through the Mishnah. We essentially took the big picture view of this fourth chapter and kind of set the stage for thinking about both the civil and criminal procedural stuff that most of this chapter will be about. And we're really going to start with the Gemara tonight. So a couple notes on that. As I said, it is very much encouraged that if you can get your own text on this, it can be just the traditional Talmud text. For those who like the New Steinsaltz, that's a good resource. The Shas Vilna Hechadash reset of the basic text is good. The fancy people who like Oz V'Hadar can find that. Really whatever you want. I'm gonna be putting up a screen share of the traditional Vilna page, and we'll basically work off of that. And our focus is gonna be to get some sense in the Gemara, refer to Rashi and Tosafot kind of occasionally, sometimes some other things. And then we're gonna try to figure out also how to have a little bit of interaction around it. So the chat is open. And I think what I'm gonna try tonight, we'll see how it goes, for some folks who have been here in the living room, to potentially unmute them, at least at some pause points where we're taking a little bit of discussion in, and see if we can at least sort of set a tone for those who have been in the rhythm of this. All right, great. We are on Daf Lamed Bet, Amud Aleph, at the beginning of the Gemara there. You've got the Mishnah here up on the page. This is that first long Mishnah that we did, followed by what was the second one. As Ariel asked at the end of last time, why do these get bunched up together? The divisions of the Mishnayot are not always identical between the Mishnah and the Gemara, and it kind of depends on what they want to discuss and how they wanted to organize it. So where we are now is right here in the middle where it starts Gemara. And I will remind you that our main opening point last time was, which is really the name of our perek, right? Echad dinei mamonot ve'echad dinei nefashot bedrisha v'chakira, where the echad echad formulation means they're the same. Dinei mamonot, civil, and dinei nefashot, criminal law, both share drisha and chakira, this sort of intensive interrogation of the witnesses to make sure the evidence, the testimony is correct, based on the reading that we went through last time of Mishpat Echad Yihyeh Lachem, reading that not as equality before the law, but consistency of procedure within the law. And we are now going to kind of interrogate that point about interrogation, all right? That's where the Gemara is going to begin. So the Gemara begins, Dinei mamonot, mi ba'enan drisha v'chakira? Really? Do monetary matters really require drisha v'chakira, really require that kind of intense investigation? Uraminhu, we've got another Tanaitic text, in this case, a braita, that contradicts the Mishnah's claim to that effect. Shtar shezmano katuv be'echad benisan b'shmita, uva wedim ve'amru, All right, let's understand the text and we'll understand how the Gemara is using it. So this is from Tosefta in Makot, and it's basically talking about a document that you find where it's dated, as an example here, to the first of Nisan in the Shemitah year. Okay, so in other words, you've got a day of the month, a month, and something indicating what year it is, all right? And then Edim, other witnesses, come along and say to the signatories on the document who have clearly come into court to sort of uphold the document that they've put forward, hey, how can you be saying that you saw such and such happen on the first of Nisan, you were with us in another place, all right? A kind of classic move of hazama, of edim zomamin, There's something conspiratorial here. You were not present for the thing that you're testifying for, all right? So that all happens. You would think that's curtains for the validity of the document, but actually the Breita tells us, no, the shtar is valid and the witnesses remain valid. So for those who spent a lot of time in the last parak on what invalidates a witness, you know, basically perjuring yourself on a document is one of the main things that does it. This is not considered to be perjury, okay, in any kind of form. And then we get this explanation. It's in Aramaic, and it's a little bit of a weird formulation, so it doesn't seem like maybe it's original to the Breita when you read it, but if you go check the Tosefta on Makot, you'll see it's there in slightly different formulation. Because we worry, but here worry basically means we give the benefit of the doubt, that perhaps they made it late. I don't want to say post-dated because this is going to get into the debate we'll get into in a second, but essentially they delayed it and wrote it, okay? Meaning, what do you have here? You have a case of a document where the date is the first of Nisan, okay? But we worry that the reason that the Edim say we were with you is because what actually happened is they saw this thing happen before the first of Nisan, but they write about it on the first of Nisan in another place with those witnesses. Okay, we'll come back to Rashi and Tosfot, have a little bit of a debate about this, of what the case is. But the idea is that it is possible that actually they are telling the truth that they saw something happen at a certain point in time, but they wrote about it later, okay? So therefore, it might be valid. And now how does this, so that's a law on its own, how does this affect our case of dinei mamonot, not requiring drisha v'chakira? Because the isalka datach ba'ein an drisha v'chakira, if you think that in the context of monetary matters, you have to go the whole nine yards with the witnesses and ask them everything. And here I'll just quote from the next chapter, the beginning of the fifth chapter of Sanhedrin says, Hayu bodkinotan b'sheva chakirot. When you would do this intensive interrogation of the witnesses, you would check them with seven things. And among the things there are, be'ezo shavua, be'ezo shana, be'ezo chodesh, be'chama b'chodesh, be'ezo yom, be'ezo sha'ah, be'ezo makom. All right, those are the seven things that basically they would verify very strictly. And the whole point there seems to be, if they give you an answer to one of those, and then it turns out they can't substantiate that they were there at that time, or like in this case, witnesses come along and say, at the time you are claiming to have been a witness, I know you were not there, because you're saying something happened in New York, and I was with you in Chicago at that time and place. The Edim Zomim are always in Chicago, that's at least in my Masoret from New York. In any event, if you had Drisha v'chakira, how could you say, well, we're worried they might have delayed the shtar, delayed the document and written it later? Meaning, what's the point of Drisha v'chakira if you cannot disprove the witnesses by saying, hey, you weren't there at that time and place? So that is to say, the whole sort of benefit of the doubt angle on maybe they post-dated the document, maybe they wrote it at a later point in time, doesn't fit with a regime of drisha v'chakira. That is the Gemara's claim, and therefore our Mishnah's claim that echad dinei mamonot ve'echad dinei nefashot b'drisha v'chakira seems to fail. Right, now the Gemara does a sort of weird thing. V'litamich, according, sort of adopting its own alter ego, says, well, wait a minute, but according to your logic, tikshelach matniti, you should have an even bigger problem from the Mishnah. What are you running off to a Breita? What are you running off to a, let's say, authoritative but not really canonical text? to try to challenge this, you can go to a Mishnah. Shtarei chov hamukdamim psulim v'hameucharim ksherim. We have an explicit Mishnah that says that IOU documents that are predated, that are dated prior to the time of the loan. So a loan's made on the 1st of Nisan, and you write a document that says, I borrowed such and such from you on the 15th of Adar, even though you did borrow from that person, and you're writing it, you know, after the loan happened, the fact that it is dated back to the 15th of Adar invalidates it. Whereas if you borrow money on the 1st of Nisan and you write a document that says, I borrowed from you on the 15th of Nisan, that is valid. Now, what's the concern here and what's the lack of concern? So for those who've encountered this before, you will know or remember, the concern here is teruf lakochot, which is to say the date on a shtar is really mainly important in order to establish who has priority of collection as a creditor, okay? So the loan happened. In other words, if you're not lying, I owe you $100, and until I pay you back, you're not gonna destroy it. So there's nothing really problematic about the date early or late vis-a-vis the loan itself. The problem is if I write a 15 Adar document for a 1st of Nisan loan, and then I run out of money, and there was someone who had a claim on me from something from the 23rd of Adar, well, now suddenly your IOU is going to preempt theirs because you've got a 15 of Adar document, which is prior to the 23rd of Adar. And you shouldn't be able to do that because your loan was only actually on the 1st of Nisan, which is later. So a shtar mukdam is rendered completely invalid. As Rashi points out here, it's not just invalid for collections from the 15th to the 1st. In other words, there's a knas, there's a sort of a penalty. Once that was done sloppily, the whole thing is totally wiped out. Whereas a shtar me'uchar, Rashi has a nice formulation here. Rashi says, shtar echov hamukdamim psulim, let's just find this next part. Right, v'hamucharin ksherin, right here at the bottom in Rashi. Ksherin, post-dated documents, as it were, are valid. De'ma'al yutahi, because truth be told, it's even better. De'kamachele l'shiabuda ad hashta, because what you're effectively willing to do is to say, I owe you money, and I won't allow someone to use this loan to kind of collect against me until a later point in time. Meaning from the perspective of shiabud karkaot and the perspective of teruf lakochot, where the concern is, are you gonna unfairly take someone else's thing? So a late document is basically the creditor saying, yeah, you owe me money, but I'm gonna even give a longer window before I can do it. We got a couple questions here coming in on the chat. So one is, what happens if you write the document and then don't actually make the loan? Well, that would be a problem. That would be pretty stupid. That is to say, no love, no borrower would really ever do that. It wouldn't necessarily quite be like a counterterrorism episode where you're only handing over a flight recorder once you're giving someone back. You see where my head is on the Homeland finale from a couple nights ago, but it might, there's a kind of broader assumption of you're only going to write the IOU once the money is being handed over. So that's one case. The other case that can happen is you could have a loan without a document. And in general, the assumption is that loans without documents are not actually able, they don't create a shiabud nechassim. You can't use a loan that hasn't been written down as a basis for basically yanking someone else's property away from them because they bought it after the loan, because the assumption is essentially it's only a matter of record if it's been written down, and therefore you're kind of taking your chances with some kind of oral piece. All right, so people are asking some questions. Yeah, so a loan with witnesses but not records, I wouldn't say doesn't have standing, but it doesn't have authority to kind of interfere with other purchases. It sort of stands on its own. You can collect it if the guy has money and you're able to prove it with witnesses. But without a document, you're not gonna be able to go and collect against someone else's purchases. And again, be torefet alakochot, take away the thing that they've done. All right, I got a bunch of concerns here about the shtar mukdam. Can't the shtar mukdam be written after the loan occurred, just state that it happened before it actually did? There might be ways you could play with it, but in general, because of the abuse of a shtar mukdam and the possibility that it's people trying to scam other people, as another commenter said, it's just basically invalidated, okay? So, all right, that's, again, we haven't even really sort of gotten through the full question here, but the idea is what we're saying is we've got two texts that say a shtar mi'uchar is kasher, all right? It's sort of like, you can think of it like a post-dated check. It's not quite a post-dated check, because a post-dated check is sort of when you give someone license. It's not saying, I handed this over to you, you know, as a historical fact on such date. But, you know, broadly speaking, if that's helpful, a post-dated check is something that is fine. And we have that both in a Braita and in a Mishnah. And the question is, how does that square with Zrishan Hakira, which is all about exactly nailing down what are the witnesses saying happened at this place or that place? And if we trip them up with a contradiction, it should be curtains for the testimony. All right. And that line is continued here. So Valita Mich, Tikshele Madnitin, Shtarechova Muktamim Sulin, Vamuharim Sherim, the Isauka Datach Bain and Drishava Hakira, Muharin, Amaik Sherin. All right. The moment we're in is actually the Gemara saying, why did you ask that question from the Braita and not from the Mishnah? We're still going to have to answer the question, but we're in a like secondary question. Why did we pick that? And again, Rashi here, just sort of in clarifying this, is basically like, you would always ask from a Mishnah rather than from a Braita. Velita michi, or Rashi in the bottom where my cursor is, velita mich de motvat mi braita, you're bringing a challenge from a Tanaitic text outside of the Mishnah, otiv mi matnitin, de alima, for it is stronger, has even more canonicity and authority to it, umitsuya befichol, and everyone knows it. Meaning this is reflecting something else interesting, which is everyone in the Amoraic Talmudic system was basically assumed to know all of the Mishnah by heart, or to have easy access to it. It was not assumed that they knew all lesser canonical Tanaitic texts by heart. And so therefore, the question is, why are you going to the more obscure text? You should have gone to the more central text. Okay, so we're gonna answer that micro question now. Halakashya, no, it's not a problem. It's a good reason we went to the Braita. The Adifa Minaka Amrina, because the challenge from the Braita, I don't care if the Braita's authority is less, it's a better text for making a sharper challenge to the Mishnah. De afilu echad b'nisan b'shmita, de lo shchiche enashe de mozve, de leka lemeimar shema ichruhu v'chatvuhu, de lo mera l'shtare, afilu hachi, kevan de shvit sofa mishametet machsherina. It's a better challenge. Why? Because if you paid attention to what seemed to be a stray detail in the Braita, it said, we saw such and such loan happen on the first day of Nisan in the Shemitah year. So that just sounded like it was saying, you know, 2008, okay, 2015. These happened to be years that were Shemitah years. It's mentioning that. No, that's actually a significant detail, because in Shemitah, in the sabbatical year, you're not going to find people who are going to lend money, because they're gonna lend the money and the debt is gonna be canceled a couple months later. And because of that, anyone who does lend money is certainly not going to postpone the date of the shtar, because they're only gonna shorten the window further that they can possibly collect. There's no way they are going to discount the power of their document when it is already basically running incredibly cheap. And nonetheless, what does the Baraita say? Since Shemitah debts are only canceled at the end, That is to say, it is with the onset of Rosh Hashanah in year 8 that all of the debts are canceled. Miketz sheva shanim ta'aseh shmitah. At the conclusion of 7 years, you wipe out the debts. Nonetheless, because there is still some time left, we validate the shtar. That is to say, there might still be the case that someone would have done that. So that's a very powerful text for saying, even in cases where it seems insane that you could make that claim, like the much more plausible explanation is that the witnesses are lying and they're testifying to a loan that they did not see. Nonetheless, we give them the benefit of the doubt that that might have happened. And that's why it's worth turning to that text as opposed to the Mishnah for that challenge, okay? So that wraps up why we did the Braita. And now we come back to Mikol Makom Kashya. Nonetheless, it is difficult, meaning great, you get it from the Braita, you get it from the Mishnah, however and wherever you get it from. That's what you've got to say. Okay, so Mikol Makom Kashya. So the problem on the table is Drisha V'Hakira. Okay, it doesn't seem like we've got Drisha V'Hakira in these monetary cases, and the Mishnah told us we do. So now we get this Siman Harpash. I'll let you figure out what that is standing for. Amar Rabbi Chanina, Dvar Torah, Echad Dinei Mamonot ve'Echad Dinei Nefashot b'Drisha V'Hakira, Shne'emar Mishpat Echad Yihye Lachem. Umata Amru Dinei Mamonot Lo Ba'Einan Drisha V'Hakira. Okay, so first answer, Rabbi Chanina says, De'oraita, on the biblical level, actually, Dinei Mamonot and Dinei Nefashot require Drisha V'Chakira because of Mishpat Echad Yihye Lachem, demanding consistency of procedure. But why did they say, all right, we'll come back to this in a minute, why did they say, Dinei Mamonot, monetary matters, don't require Drisha V'Chakira, so that we would not lock the doors in the presence of borrowers. All right, so some who have, you know, studied, know this phrase more broadly from Prosbul and from a number of other things, where counterintuitively, we sometimes do things that are bad for lenders in order to ensure that there is a market for lending. If you make it too favorable to the lender, the credit will simply dry up. So Shemitah, an entire institution that is about creating some kind of economic justice through debt forgiveness, ends up boomeranging back with the Prosbul and basically Chazal realizing, oh my God, this whole, you know, beautiful, lofty idea of Shemitah in the Torah is actually just making creditors run as fast as they can in the other direction. They won't lend any money because they know they're not going to get paid back. So we're going to enable them to carry their loans through the sabbatical year. So here too, what's happening? Drisha V'Chakira is an institution which is meant on some level to protect lenders from having crooked people get money out of them, right? Or they're not really lenders, right? It's to prevent people from having money taken out of their pocket. If you get rid of Drisha V'Chakira, you allow people to collect debts more easily. And the boomerang effect, at least in theory, of allowing people to collect more debts easily is there will be a freer flow of cash, okay? So, right, this is a general problem with, like, is it better to have money that can be lent on interest? Because the only way you're ever going to have some kind of free flow of funds is if there's people willing to put that money out there. Or is that just setting up the conditions for people being treated in a predatory fashion? That's always some kind of balance here. But what seems like it's going on is, at least according to Rabbi Chanina, is it's almost like they tried the system of being as harsh and interrogative about the monetary system as the capital system, and it ended up redounding to the detriment of borrowers. Rashi has a great way that he puts it here, which really gives you a sort of stark historical picture. The last line in Rashi on the page, Amar Rabbi Hanina, umatnitin deoraita kame takanta, uvraita derabanan batar takanta. Literally, it's like a historical timeline here. The Mishnah represents some earlier point in time where there was drisha v'chakira on everything. And Rabbi Hanina says those other braitot, and seemingly actually even that Mishnah, which is from Masechet Shvi'it, represent a later point in economic time where the Chachamim had to make a takana because they were like, this is not working. This is not playing it. Okay? So that's Rabbi Hanina's suggestion. All right, but Rabbi Hanina's answer is basically a historical answer and means that a huge part of the Mishnah, according to Rabbi Hanina, is a dead letter. Like it's been phased out. In fact, the whole opening phrase that defines the whole tone, Mishpat Echad Yeh Lachem, it was like, nah, actually that doesn't work. So we're not having that. Okay.
Ethan? Okay.
Yes, go ahead, David.
Sorry. So it's Jed.
Oh, Jed, great.
So, unless I interrupted David, in which case I apologize.
No, I don't think so. I think I just heard two voices. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So the idea here is that at some point they abolished drisha v'chakira because it made it too difficult for creditors to enforce their debts and thus acted as a disincentive to additional lending. Is that the idea?
Yes, that seems to be Rabbi Hanina's idea.
Right, Rabbi Hanina's idea. But I mean, unlike Shemitah and Prusbul, which operate against both legitimate debts and illegitimate debts, you know, drisha v'chakira seems to be a tool that just weeds out false claims of indebtedness or illegitimate claims. So it seems like a blunt and bad change that wouldn't necessarily have the effect they're aiming for here. I don't know if there's more on that, but it seems different from the Prusbul in what it eliminates versus what it facilitates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's good. I think I want to sort of track whether, as we go through some of the other Amoraic responses here, whether maybe that's a piece of them rejecting Rabbi Hanina. I have to think about it. But just so I get what you're saying, your point is that Drisha v'Chakira is fundamentally about eliminating falsehood as opposed to favoring one side in the equation. And your response to the fact of, yeah, but that falsehood is fundamentally about enabling people to get out of paying, right? Because Hamotzi Mechavero Alav Araya, it always starts with the money's in someone's pocket. And the question is, can we pick their pocket to give it to someone else? Drisha v'Chakira, in that sense, favors the status quo, which is a version of favoring someone who borrowed or potentially borrowed money, is it not? Like, I get what you're saying conceptually, it's just about accuracy, which is clearly on some level the Mishnah's perspective of Mishpat Echad Yeh Lachem. Like, hey, shouldn't our legal system be like very precise no matter what it is, no matter how, you know, unimportant it seems? But I think Rabbi Hanina is saying, but tachlis, collections go one direction. I mean, look, to go back to a question that I think other people asked along the way, which is, there seems to be a yawning gap between Dinei Mamonot and Dinei Nefashot, unless Dinei Mamonot means anything that's not Dinei Nefashot, right? In other words, what's going to be the story with, are we going to do Drisha and Chakira on Gitin and Kiddushin? Are we going to do Drisha and Chakira on tort cases, right? That we're going to get to in a second. Okay, where we sort of see where some of that goes. But I think so far, Shalotin Odelet Bifnei Lovin is imagining, even if this is about accuracy, its effect is disproportionate because it's about collections in most cases, or the cases he cares about, it's going to disproportionately affect one group. But I hear your point.
No. I guess, look, it's a very realist perspective that says, look, this tool that sounds so accurate has both kinds of errors, and therefore net, practically at the end of the day, we're better off getting rid of it because it will facilitate the flow of lending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just saw on the side here where Shalotin Odelef Snei Lovin, is that Rabbi Hanina? What is the Sheyimnu Milhalvot Shema Yichpor Yeah,
I think that's Rabbeinu Hananel.
Rabbeinu Hananel.
Yeah.
So he seems to think that witnesses, maybe by their nature, are imprecise. So if you push them too much, the witnesses in favor of the creditors may not be exact, and then the creditor will lose. And obviously, if he's afraid that that's going to happen, he won't lend money.
Mm-hmm.
And just broadly, can we sort of apply, you know, what this famous Ron, that there are two levels of halacha, a type of ideal justice on one hand, and then a more practical, utilitarian, rough and ready for functioning of society justice?
Yeah, so this, I think, is a big question. And on some level, we briefly addressed this last week on a meta level, which is how much is this really happening? And how much is this playing out certain ideals and values in terms of the whole system? And then, yeah, you're taking us down to sort of even one level below that, which is, okay, but even within a functioning system, what are we actually, you know, going to implement and when? When do we have makin ba'onshin shalomina Torah, the notion that sometimes there's almost vigilante capital and corporal punishment because we have to keep order? Those are all questions that are very real here. And let's push forward here and see where the other pieces go. But these are great. I think what's striking about this resolution is the way it seems in its pshat, but also in a way that Rashi really lays bare to be a kind of almost historical development explanation. Okay, the Mishnah is giving you the Torah law, and you are getting the other law later. That's Rashi. You could imagine reading Rabbi Hanina as if Rabbi Hanina thinks, actually, there never was Drisha and Chakira on Dinei Mamonot, like it's just some theoretical statement of the Mishnah. That seems too much for Rashi to abide. He imagines our Mishnah must have been practical at some point, and therefore he imagines it is undone. It's an interesting question in terms of authority to think about what does it mean for something, as Rashi claims it here, to be deoraita, and then for someone, for the rabbis to sort of come along and be like, nah, we're not going to do that because it's not getting to the desired outcomes. You know, it's always easier in monetary law to play that out because it's almost like you're making a takanat kahal. Everyone's just going to agree they own things, you know, based on these sort of conditions. All right, let's go a little further. Ela me ata. All right. However, once you say that, we do not have Drisha v'Hakira in Dinei Mamonot because of this concern of Shalotin Ol Delet Bifnei Lovin. Okay, switching now to Lamed Bet Amud Bet. Ta'u Lo Yishalmu. So, well, then truth be told, if judges make an error, they shouldn't have to pay out of pocket. So this is a sort of general rule. And those of us who did the third parak, had some surprising discussions about this, where at least unless you get a certain exemption or you're a certain level, if you are a judge who makes a certain kind of error in judgment, you potentially have to pay out of pocket to make recompense for that. And it's a sort of like, you know, incentive for judges to get it right, and also some sense of accountability in the system for people to go to those judges. That actually makes the more the system depends on the buy-in of the litigants, as opposed to it being like a centralized government that's imposing it, the more that actually makes sense in some way. It's like, why am I going to hold myself accountable to this person? Do they have skin in the game? But the idea of ta'u lo yishalmu, so you look at Rashi here on the top, ta'u beidin bedinei mamunot, if you're going to say that there's no drisha v'chakira, so then if a Beit Din makes an error in a monetary case, lo yishalmu, they shouldn't have to pay. The deal ma ishavkat lo lidrosh v'lachkor hava rav chalamilta v'lo avutau. If you had allowed them to do drisha v'chakira, they might not have made the error. That is to say, once you forbid a certain degree of interrogation of the facts in monetary cases, so part of what you're admitting into the system is, yeah, there's going to be more people who are wrongly decided against, who are wrongly collected against. And to the extent that that sometimes comes to light after the fact, the Gemara is saying, well then, right, they shouldn't have to pay. And the answer is, no, Kol Shekein Shatino Delet Bifnei Lovin. That's going to make it even worse for borrowers. Demit Yarin Lafsid Al Yedei Beit Din Toin, says Rashi. Because once you take away the penalty from the judges that they'll have to pay, so then what's going to happen is the people who are lending money are going to say, well, forget it. If I get a wrong decision, there's no way I'm going to recoup it because the judges are not going to have to pay. They're not going to have to make me whole. And therefore, I'm staying away from this whole system. So in other words, the sort of follow-up to Rabbi Hanina is the only way you can really stack the deck in favor of borrowers, all right? Or to be more precise, avoid the deck being stacked against borrowers who are always on the bottom of the economic totem pole, is to basically have a more loosey-goosey system for investigating the documents, but also require judges to pay, even though that is not, you know, always going to feel so fair to them. Now, we're not addressing here at what point is there going to be a cratering out of the judge economy, right? Like, forget about judicial pay not being good enough. This is like judicial negative pay being too significant. That doesn't seem to be addressed here. And we're either coasting enough on the prestige of being a judge or some notion of call of duty or some notion that you have an obligation, you know, even under the Torah, when you know enough to decide those cases. Okay, but that wraps up basically Rabbi Hanina. Okay, now we're going to get to basically three other resolutions. And we'll get through to the end of this sugya and maybe two follow-up braitot, I hope, that come out of it. Remember, we go from 8 to 9:15. That's our timetable. All right. Rava Amar, Matznitin dehacha bedinei knasot, ve'idach behodaot ve'halvaot. So here we have a different division. It's not early, late. It's not the oraita de Rabbanan, though it's a little bit of that. But the Mishnah is still operative. It's just operative in dinei knasot. What's dinei knasot? Dinei knasot is basically things like torts, okay? Basically things where it's not about fines and things where it's like, this person got their hand chopped off, you have to pay them back this amount of money. But it's not about collecting a debt. It's not about cases of admitting you owe someone money or people witnessing loans. We have drisha and hakira in monetary matters that are not about sort of collecting loans. We don't have drisha v'chakira in hoda'ot v'alva'ot. Now, if you pay attention, Rava is really just a version of Rabbi Hanina, right? In the sense that Rabbi Hanina's basic orientation is the reason we don't have drisha v'chakira is we're worried about shutting down the loan market. And Rava says, great, that makes sense to me. But then you can just say the Mishnah's maintenance of drisha v'chakira for dinei mamonot is for all the dinei mamonot that are not about loans. Just split the Mishnah and the Braitot in that way. The Mishnah and the Braita split it in that way. All right, madnitin dahacha, this Mishnah in Sanhedrin, dinei knasot. But the other text that doesn't seem to have drisha v'chakira because it's allowing you this crazy late-dated shtar, that's hoda'ot v'alva'ot. All right, so that's resolution two, but in some ways you could say Rabbi Hanina is 1A and Rava is 1B. All right, let's say it that way. And then Rav Papa is 2. Rav Papa amar, idi ve'idi behoda'a v'halva'a, kan bedin merume, kan bedin she'eino merume. No, says Rav Papa. That's ridiculous. The Mishnah, it said dinei mamonot, right? It didn't say dinei knasot. It's everything. Everything across the board. There's drisha v'chakira. So when do you do drisha v'chakira in dinei mamonot and when don't you? It depends how you see it going. Is it a din mirumeh, literally a cheated judgment, or is it a din she'eino mirumeh? All right, Rashi says here on mirumeh, shebeit din makirin b'tovei azeh shehu ramai. Oh, mevinim ta'anat ramai bidvarav. They recognize that this guy who's coming to collect is a ramai, He has a record of running phone scams on the elderly. He has a record of a million things that they know. They can feel it. There may not even be a record. Or even if the person doesn't have a reputation of a Ramai, but they just sense, they hear the story and something sounds off, there is then judicial discretion to apply drisha v'chakira in monetary cases. Whereas if it's a run-of-the-mill case, you are not allowed, or it is inappropriate to do that. That too seems like it's in a way we could say this is 1C in a different way too. And I'll come back to this in a minute on the characters involved here. But it is a little more firmly in its own camp in terms of basically saying the dividing line here is not really hoda ot val va'ot. It's, do you sense something fishy is going on? But we're still, but the din she'eino merumeh, when there's nothing fishy going on, it still seems like the reason you don't do drisha v'chakira is for the fear of hoda'ot v'halva'ot being scrutinized too much, you will shut down the loan market. And here we get a parallel, kidei Reish Lakish, quoted from another text, where Reish Lakish, de Reish Lakish rami k'tiv, b'tzedek tishpot amitecha, u'ktiv tzedek tzedek tirdov. Ha-ketzad, kan bedin merumeh, kan bedin she'ein merumeh. Reish Lakish used to rame, literally to throw. I think of it as like, I always have the image of like a particle accelerator where you're smashing two particles against each other. You take a pasuk from one place and a pasuk from another place. They seem to be giving you mixed messages. And through that dialectic, you produce some kind of distinction between two cases or two modes. So this is right, midrashim, you really feel better when you think of meaning, you sense their meaning better if you've had the gift of reading Torah, or you know the Torah like really well by heart. It's very hard to hear b'tzedek tishpot amitecha and not to hear an echo of tzedek tzedek tirdof. And then you start wondering, why is it doubled in one and why not in the other? Why isn't it b'tzedek, b'tzedek tishpot amitecha? Or why isn't it just tzedek tirdof? Reish Lakish wondered that and said, that's because there's two kinds of din. Betzedek tishpot amitecha is a case where, yeah, do a good job, just like get to the right answer. Tzedek tzedek tirdof is, you better really find out what happened here. And Reish Lakish basically said, and we don't know what Reish Lakish's motivation is, but if I were to say what I think his motivation is, and certainly how they're picking up on it here, well, I don't know if it's how they're picking up on it here, but one possible motivation for Reish Lakish is there's sort of this tension between keeping the courts and the cases moving and leaving no stone unturned in terms of getting it right. And I think Reish Lakish is saying, look, when it's a din she'ein merumeh, you don't sense anyone is doing anything fishy here. You got to reach a decision, move forward, get to the next case, make sure you look at it and make a decision, shouldn't be false, and move on. And then there are cases where basically the task that has fallen to you is to uncover some duplicitousness that is running amok in the system in your case. And that's the tzedek tzedek moment, all right? Rav Papa seems to be using that split to get at the notion of drisha v'chakira, all right? Whether Reish Lakish is exactly talking about what they're talking about here, not clear, right? It's kidei Reish Lakish, but Reish Lakish's principle of you sometimes apply stricter rules of justice, as it were, or justice pursuit than you do in other places. Reish Lakish here is being marshaled to say, that explains why we sometimes have drisha v'chakira and sometimes not in dinei mamonot, subject to judicial discretion. Okay. And then the last one, and then I'll pause for some comments and questions. Rav Ashi Amar, Matnitin Kiddushanin, Krae Echad Ledin VeEchad LePshara. So Rav Ashi says, yeah, you know, our Mishnah, as we resolved it, meaning, Rashi says this nicely, he says, Matniyata, he has the multiple brightot, Shapir itartzu b'chad mehane shinuye. Okay, those were taken care of nicely with any of the resolutions you just heard. Ikar Rabbi Hanina, Ikar Rava, Ikar Rav Papa. Pick whoever you want. That's fine. It's basically, I have nothing to add to that. But the verses that you now quoted in the name of Reish Lakish, that I have a different reading. The difference between Betzedek Tishpor Amitecha and Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof is one of those is for din and one of them is for pshara. One of those is for an actual judgment and the other is for some kind of compromise or arbitration. Here again, Rashi, Betzedek Tishpot, Veloktiv, Betzedek, Tzedek, Leaz here Beit Din, Ledakdek Bo Kolkach, Lidrosh Velachkor. Tzedek, Tzedek Tirdof is a language of do not let anything inaccurate end up in your judgment. And that is Din. Betzedek Tishpor Amitecha is like, find a way for it to come out right. And so Rav Ashi says, that's not just like move it along and don't look. Once you're doing din, it seems to be Rav Ashi says, you're going to have to focus on every single aspect. When you're doing pshara, you're just trying to get the parties to stand down and to settle, right? And there, something that's fair and that they agree to is fine. You don't need the double tzedek in order to have fulfilled your obligation, okay? Let me pause there. We're going to get into it sort of mid-sentence because Rav Ashi is going to be referring to a braita that we'll get to. But any thoughts on that flow? First of all, did people figure out what the siman at the bottom here of the previous page, siman harpash, stands for? So the harpash there, it's Rashi Tevot for Hanina? The sages. There we go. All right, we got a few. Hanina, Rava, Papa, and then Ashi.
Ashi.
Yes, very good. Right? Harpash, and the Ash gets you the Ashi there. Which also shows you that those were likely oral little mnemonics. Steinsaltz gave it away. So, all right, whatever. Well, fine. We won't hold it against you. So we've got those four things. Any other comments on this piece?
It obviously sounds like a double standard in a legal system. Is this something that exists in other legal systems? That if you think the case is solid, you have one standard, and if you think it's iffy,
yeah, I don't know. Our fellow lawyers in the group, yeah, right. Ariella, Beth, Jed, like any, what do you say about the discretion piece of how far you push the investigation?
I think in a situation, it's not, if it's strictly a litigation, I don't think you would have a different standard. If you were arbitrating or trying to come to a mediated resolution, which seems more similar to me to pshara, then the system, I think that the standard should be more loose.
Mm-hmm. And you would admit to it up front. I'm taking a closer look here and I'm not in the other case.
In a case where you were acting as a mediator rather than a judge, sure.
Cool.
Or if the judge says, I'm not acting as a judge right at the moment, come into the back of my, come into my room, into my chambers, and we're going to have a discussion. I'm going to try to make you guys settle this.
Right. So this is a little bit of the question of the blending. There's a little bit of a blending of Rav Papa and Rav Ashi here. Like Rav Ashi, once you get into Din and Pshara, all kinds of things open up. I think part of what you're struck by, Sally, is Rav Papa seems still to be in Din, and yet he's saying, yeah, you sort of see how it goes, right? And then decide. But that still may, right, that still may have, legal corollaries as well.
So just a comment on this.
Yeah.
And, someone just alluded to it in the chat, right? There is this notion of summary judgment, which basically says there are no issues of fact here that require a full-blown trial. That's a little bit different because that basically gives each side a chance to say, yes, there are, no, there aren't. And if there's no issue of fact that needs a trial, then you don't need a trial. You decide it based on the law and the facts. The Rav Papa difference here is that it seems motivated by a quick peek, not at the merits, but at sort of the character of the claimant and what we deduce from that about the merits. That's the piece that seems to me unfair, right? Even sharp characters make legitimate loans sometimes. So so that seems to jump out. I mean, look, so you have summary adjudication all the time, but in different contexts where there's just nothing else that requires a jury, for example, to decide, is this person telling the truth or is that person telling the truth?
Yeah, you know, just on the question of, and then David Morris going to get you in here. No, your point is taken. Okay, so kan bedim merume, you know, what is the range of what we're talking about here? So Rashi, I think, in part to be like, hey, why are we sort of, you know, totally going after this guy, tries to make a pretty high bar. He's like, well, they know he's a Ramai, right? Now the Tosfot jump in here and they say, well, lo she yodim bo shehu merume, the imkein ein la duno klal, kedidashina beperek shvuat ayidud, midvar sheker tirchak. I mean, if you know it's actually outright false, you can't give it the dignity of a judicial proceeding. So they're trying to figure out a sort of gray area here. Now, this goes to sort of the meta claim that I think you could ask about this whole sugya. We haven't totally covered the last piece, but we'll get to that in a second, which is sort of, what's the structure here? Someone put up a comment earlier about the Yerushalmi. You know, the Rav Papa here, on some level, if just taken as a statement of law, well, this is how it plays out, raises these questions. How? What do you mean? It's Sally's saying, right? How can you have a sort of double standard? When thought about as sort of a problem of text, what Rav Papa's doing is best to try to figure out, I got one Mishnah that's a sense thing on Drisha v'Chakira and another that doesn't seem to care. So what am I supposed to do with that? And the best he seems to be able to come up with is this. In other words, the alternative is just to kill off one of the Mishnayot on some level. I mean, Rabbi Hanina seems to have just retired it. It's in the dustbin of history somewhere before the Takanta. And Rav Papa's trying to say, how can I hold on to the sort of ongoing validity of the Mishnah here and the ongoing validity of this Baraita? I don't want to historicize the texts in terms that they belong to different periods. So the shortcoming is we're operating with two systems. The value added is we're not killing either of the values that were presented in authoritative text, which seems on some level to be competing with each other. Now, there's another aspect here which I think is interesting, which is if you pay attention to who's speaking here, Rabbi Hanina is an Amora from Eretz Israel, and Rabbi Rav Papa and Rav Ashi are all fourth generation and later Babylonian Amoraim. And in particular, Rava is known for responding to Torah that comes in from Eretz Yisrael and beginning to sort of set the agenda of the Babylonian discussion based on it. It doesn't seem like anyone before Rava and Bavel ever really talked about this issue, or maybe even had a notion that Drisha v'Chakira was not operative. Like that itself is not clear. And if you go in the Yerushalmi, you see very clearly there is a parallel to Reish Lakish's statement here. And that's sort of the main thing that they have there. So without, you know, I'm really learning this through for the first time with you. So I can't give you like my, you know, the results of my doctoral research on this, but the kind of questions that like would come up with me for me would say, huh, how were, if at all, were they thinking about this prior to the fourth generation in Bavel? And is part of what's coming on up in our sugya is suddenly people who have taken Drisha v'Chakira for granted as a part of the monetary system are being confronted with an idea or a tradition that says, hey, we don't fully do that. And they're trying to find a way to fit that in. And you can imagine judicial discretion as being one piece of that. And even as Rav Ashi pivots us away from that and is sort of like, great, however you work out the Mishnayot, he's trying to say, the verses are about Din and Pshara. I don't really want to read back into the Torah, I think, Rav Ashi is saying, some notion that sometimes the judge does it this way within the context of Din and sometimes not. He's like, I can swallow that sometimes the judge moves to be an arbiter. But if you're doing Din, it better be Tzedek Tzedek Tirdo. Okay, that line of Rav Ashi ends with kidetanya, that is to say, as support for my idea that the difference between Betzedek Tishpor Amitecha and Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof is the difference between Din and Pshara, we bring the following Braita, and it's a famous one that you may have encountered. Kidetanya, Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof, Echad Ledin Ve'Echad Lepshara. Ketzad, Shtei Sfinot Ovrod Banahar Ufagu Ze Bazeh. Im ovrot shteyen, shteyen tovot. V'ze achar ze, shteyen ovrot. You have two ships that are passing a narrow strait. If they both insist, no, I was here first, or even we got here at the same time, but you don't get precedence over me, so I'm not backing down. They're basically playing a game of sailing chicken here. If they insist on maintaining their course, they will basically both run aground and both of the ships will be destroyed by running up against, you know, rocks on the side or something like that. But if they agree somehow for one of them to go through first, they can both pass. One of them just has to wait, okay? This is the, right, the classic evergreen Seinfeld parking episode, okay? Someone coming in from the front, someone from the back, the same spot, they can just stand there all day, okay? But if they agree somehow, that's sharing one thing, right? Here, they don't have to share, just one person has to give someone else present. V'chein shnei gmalim, sh'ayu olim b'ma'alot beit choron ufagu ze b'zeh, imalu shnehen, shnehen oflin, b'zeh achar zeh, shnehen olin. So it seems like near Beit Horon today, right, on the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv corridor, there is some kind of path winding up a hill there where you basically reached a one-track road situation. And if you both insisted on going, you would fall off what was essentially a very narrow path with cliffs on both sides, and both of the camels would fall down, and all the stuff they were laden with would be lost. Whereas if one yields to the other, great. So how do you make them yield? Haketzad, te'una v'sheina te'una, tidache she'ina te'una v'pnei te'una. If one of them's carrying a load or a bigger load, they should get precedence. Krova v'sheina krova, tidache krova v'pnei she'ina krova. Who has a longer distance to go? Person who has a longer way to go, let them go first. Hayu shtehen krovot, shtehen rechokot. If there's no way to break the tie, hatel pshara b'nehem, uma'alot sachar zo lazo. Make some kind of agreement. And it's not just, can someone be nice to the other person? The pshara here is, someone should pay for the rights to go first. Modest, presumably modest enough that they'll agree to it and it won't just trigger the same stubbornness. There's probably some degree of generosity, but you make some display of appreciation for the fact that one person yielded. It's like, you go first and you will buy me a Starbucks card, right? It's like something like that. The pshara element here is the notion that it's not really deep, okay? It's not really making it fair, but it's an impossible situation. And this breita bases that on the pasuk tzedek tzedek tirdof, which, if you note, is being read here as the judge has to perform two different kinds of tzedek. Okay, it's not like it was read before, where tzedek tzedek is a relentless pursuit of justice, and tzedek tishpor amitecha is like, yeah, mild pursuit of justice. It's B'tzedek tishvara mitecha, for Rav Ashi, is relentless din. Tzedek tzedek tirdof is, I want you to pursue both relentless din and arbitration. Those are two tools in your toolbox. You have to learn how to use both of them. All right, so tzedek tzedek tirdof is not like v'ayayim shamoa tishme'u. It is not a doubling of the intensity of what you're pursuing. It's actually kind of a fork in the road that is saying, go this way, go that way, depending on the kind of tzedek that is required in that context, okay? Now, just to take us here to the end of this little unit, and then we'll have time for a couple comments. Tanu Rabbanan, we riff further on tzedek tzedek tirdof. Tzedek tzedek tirdof, halocha achar beit din yafe, achar Rabbi Eliezer lelod, achar Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai livror chayil. So here, tzedek tzedek tirdof in this braita is read yet a different way. I would read it as, they're reading it as, pursue just justice, which is to say there are a lot of batei din that are courts in form, but they're not necessarily good. And therefore you should seek out the kind of tzedek that is itself tzedek. It's a good court. And two standout cases of that are, go to Rabbi Eliezer's court in Lod and go to Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's court in Bror Chayil. All right, Bror Chayil is down at a kibbutz today. It was founded in 1948, and it's down near Sderot, near Aza. And clearly Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was down there. It's not so far from where Yavna was, where he decamps to. So in any event, these are two places. We then get a little side information about them, about Bror Chayil. Tna, this is clearly only here because Bror Chayil is an unusual place. So we're stuffing in everything we know about it here. Tna, kol rechayim bevurni shavua haben shavua haben. Or haner bivror chayil mishtesham mishtesham. Okay, what's going on here? When the millstone is heard in the town of Burni, it means a circumcision, a circumcision. But the repetition here seems to be, it is in place of someone running around the town saying, Shavua ben, Shavua ben, literally the week of the sun, but it was an expression for a brit milah. And when you saw a candle, presumably in someone's house in Bror Chayil, it meant it was the equivalent of, there's a wedding over there, there's a wedding over there. Again, it is replacing what seems to have been a practice of saying, Mishtesha, Mishtesha. Okay? Rashi gives one conventional explanation of what's going on here. Shavua ben, Shavua ben. Simanu sheyesham brit milah. Kemachriz veomer shavua abenka. Varechaim siman leshechikat samamanin lamakata tinok. Why do they use a millstone? Because one of the things they do as a kind of, medicinal after treatment to the brit milah was to grind up spices. They talk about cumin in the Mishnah and other things. So this was the code. Why do we need a code? Sha'at gzeirata malchutaya. This is the Hadrianic persecutions. Shegazru shelo lamul. It was forbidden to circumcise. Vayu yireim lo tzikol v'kavu simanze. The circumcisions were done at home, not because of pandemics and other things like that, but because of fear of persecution. And the same thing with the Or Haner, they no longer were allowed to announce weddings. And so they had to do it underground and undercover. There's actually an amazing Tosfot here, where he's explaining this, Kol Rechaim Beburni, explaining that it's the Hadrianic persecutions. And after explaining, yeah, this is what they would do, then says, where my cursor is here, V'hadichtiv b'Yirmiyah, but if you go to Jeremiah chapter 25, it says, V'ha'avadeti mehem kol sason v'kol simcha, kol chatan v'kol kala, kol Rechaim ve'or ner. Back in the Bible, there is an association between a millstone and a candle, but this is v'ha'avaditi mehem. This is, I will get rid of them, implying that the sound of the millstone and the light of the candle are things that are happening, that are good, that are going to be wiped out. Now, it could be this pasuk just means, yeah, they're not going to be milling anything because everyone's going to be poor and they'll have no wheat and they won't have any fuel. So there won't be an or ner. But the Tosfot is saying it's a little odd that it's juxtaposed to kol chatan kol kala, and they suggest, I think really amazingly, ika lemeimar shagam barishona yuasin simanin elu l'shem simcha, meaning that maybe actually no, what the millstone and the light in the window are all that's left. They're not really sort of like a code that they invented during the Hadrianic persecutions, but all that's left now is sort of this pathetic remnant of how they used to announce things, all right? That's filling out the Bror Chayil. And finally, I'll just do this last piece. The last piece is, Tanu Rabbanan, Tzedek Tzedek Tirdov, Haloch Achar Chachamim HaYeshiva. Okay, so this, I think, is super interesting because I think what this is really doing is saying, no, Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof is not about finding a court at all. It's about finding a place to learn the laws. Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof, if you really want to kind of truly understand what justice is about, you don't go just as a litigant to a court to find to, you know, receive justice. You actually go to pursue it as a pursuit, and that you're going to do in the yeshiva. And then we get a list of everyone's yeshiva. If you've read The Orchard, HaPardes Shel Akiva by Yochi Brandes, then you know this is where she gets all the subtitles of the book. Achar Rabbi Eliezer, Lelod. Achar Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai, Livror Chaya. Achar Rabbi Yoshua, Lifki'in, up in the north. Achar Rabban Gamliel, Liyavne. Achar Rabbi Akiva, Livnei Brak. Achar Rabbi Matia, Liromi. Rabbi Matia is in Rome. Achar Rabbi Hananya Ben Tradion, Lisichni. Sichnin, Sachnin, Arab village up in the north today. Achar Rabbi Yosei Litzipori. Achar Rabbi Yehuda Ben Betera, Lenitzivin. Nisibus, that's in Asia Minor. Achar Rabbi Yoshua Lagola. Now this Rabbi Yoshua is not Rabbi Yoshua Ben Hananya who's up here. This seems to be another Rabbi Yoshua or Yoshua Achi, Hananya Achi Rabbi Yoshua. A figure is often the Gola, which is a code for a certain part of Bavel. Rashi here says it's Pumbedita. Achar Rabbi Levet Shearim, if you've ever been to the National Park there in Beit Shearim and the tombs of many people clearly associated with the Sanhedrin and where the Sanhedrin was. You have an image of that. And Achar Chachamim L'Lishkat HaGazit. Lishkat HaGazit here, almost mythically, that's of course the Sanhedrin in the chamber of hewn stone on Har HaBayit. Not in any chronological sense ordered here, but seemingly put at the end, both establishing Lishkat HaGazit as a kind of a yeshiva, a court that is a yeshiva, and also sort of putting the Chachamim in some broad way as a manifestation of that. Okay, other comments here?
Yeah, this Gemara about the two ships and the two, Shtei Svinot and the Shnei Gmalim is ironically appropriate for Yom HaAtzma'ut, because that was the subject of the famous discussion between Ben-Gurion and the Chazon Ish.
Mm-hmm.
When Ben-Gurion and Chazon Ish met in 1951, Ben-Gurion asked the Chazon Ish, how can the religious and the secular get along in the state of Israel? And he quoted this Gemara and said, we are the ship which is laden with Torah and mitzvot, and you are just an empty ship, and therefore you should make room for us. Ben-Gurion evidently was very upset and said, what do you mean? Don't we have Binyan Haaretz? Don't we have the ideals of Tzedek? So this is almost like sort of legendary Gemara in that context.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you for bringing that. And yeah, the specter of the Agalot HaRekot right. continues to haunt secular Israeli society until right. this day. And in some ways, figures like Ruth Calderon and all sorts of other people who have been certainly involved in like the Bialik revival are fighting that boogeyman. And then we can have different opinions of how much did they need to, how much are they succeeding. But 100%, no, it's beautiful that that came out. Thank you for drawing that in. Yeah, Ariella.
It's a far cry from the beginning of the Gemara where justice was going to be based on reality based, you know, what do you have to do? Now they're saying real justice is not found in the real world at all. It's found in law school. You're going to read your cases in law school. That's the true justice. Out there in the world, you just have compromises and like enticing people to lend money because we won't be too hard on them later. But the true justice is found in the only in the classroom. It's really like gone far from the beginning of the sugya in that sense.
Yeah. So I think it's really it's interesting and poignant, and we can leave it there. There's always a question of like, is the sugya's final word meant to be its final word, or is it just the last thing that was redacted there? But there's certainly a way of reading it that yeah, there's sort of a trail here where they don't have control in a broader sense. There is a deep sense in which the study of the study of halacha, even a statement like after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, Ein la kadosh baruch hu ala arba amot shel halachot bilvad, that all you have is sort of, you know, you can read that as the practical law, but even sort of like the study of the law. The law schools are sort of the only things that they have going as any kind of system. So I think, yeah, that's one thing really to ponder here. And the other thing I'll leave you with to think about, we'll be moving on next time to the next bit, but I think you have a really fascinating set of drashot here on the words tzedek tzedek. that are reading them in dramatically different ways. The last one is the yeshiva, the kind of real pursuit of the knowledge of justice. But another one is there are good courts and bad courts, find the ones that do their craft well. Another one is there's different kinds of justice that are required for different environments. And then going back to when there's drisha v'chakira and when not, sometimes the judge needs to know when to turn the screws on the litigants and pursue a certain kind of tzedek tzedek. And sometimes, whether it's to keep the cases flowing or shaloli noldelet bifnei lovin, to just be satisfied with something that seems like it's basically fair. All right, fantastic. Thanks to everyone for being here. Wonderful Yom Ha'atzmaut to everyone. And looking forward to seeing you next week as we pick up the next sugya. Take care.